all of these ideas coming out of the scientific revolution were systemized by Isaac Newton in his Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, published in 1687. It was Newton who would link astronomy to physics, and one sees in Newton more a real reflection of this tremendous optimism, this confidence that man could understand the universe. It is after Newton that one has the dominant metaphor of Enlightenment thought, of the universe as a giant clock, an enormously intricate mechanism. In fact, mechanisms within mechanisms. And so the job of science, the job of all scholarly pursuit, was to, you know, observe one small part. We may be looking at one small mechanism within this gigantic clock, but we would understand the way the gears, the wheels in this one small part work, and as a consequence, one builds from that small area, this one small mechanism, to the larger and larger and larger mechanism of the great clock of the universe. These ideas then really pose the foundation, the groundwork for the mature Enlightenment of the 18th century. It would be in the 18th century that these ideas would be broadened and broadened systematically, expanded, not only in the terms of their substance, but also in terms of the audience that they would reach. In the 17th century, the scientific revolution tended by and large to be restricted to a very small group of intellectuals, cultural figures, and so on. But in the 18th century, all of this would change. And in part, that change would come as a result of a fundamental transformation in the conditions of cultural production. The stimulus and focus of creative and intellectual work shifted in the 18th century from a system of royal patronage to educated groups in society at large. In the 17th and early 18th century, intellectual life was fostered, was sponsored by royalty, by the court, or by major aristocratic figures. In the course of the 18th century, this would change. The development of wealth that we talked about in the previous lecture, the growth of something that we would now call leisure, the time to read, the time to think about these things, to write and to publish, and the self-confidence in the emerging middle rank of society, the emerging bourgeoisie of France, or the middle class in Britain. One sees also in by the 18th century a dramatic decline in the court culture, especially in France. Louis XIV's Versailles had been, as we've already observed, the cultural center of the European world. But after the death of Louis XIV in 1715, and also I might add the passage of the Stuarts, the Stuart monarchy in England at the end of the 17th century, one sees a decline in this elaborate court culture, a relative decline. It is in this period, too, that one can observe the rise of universities. They were beginning to have their impact as real centers of learning and of intellectual discourse. But I think their impact is slight compared to another area of cultural production and the distribution of cultural materials. The channels of intellectual communication shifted, and shifted dramatically in the course of the 18th century, from Versailles and monarchic courts to the salons of Paris. One saw in the 18th century the emergence of a group of freelance intellectuals, men of letters, and women of letters too, one might add, who traveled the same circles, corresponded with one another across frontiers. One thinks instantly, probably the most typical figure of the period would be Voltaire, who was perpetually in trouble in France and wound up visiting various places, even visited Frederick the Great in Sanssouci in Potsdam. But there was a sense of an international community of scholars, of intellectuals, exchanging information, exchanging views. Part of this was also made possible by the rise of an educated public and the rise of publications.